Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll talk about the situation in Israel and Palestine following the assassination of the Hamas leader, Rantisi. That followed about an assassination about a month ago of the previous head of Hamas, Sheikh Yassin. And first, we'll go to Israel and talk to Dr. David Newman, who's a professor of political geography and geopolitics at Ben-Gurion University. And he's a geographer, and of course, there's an old saying that the problem between the Israelis and the Palestinians is that there's too much history and not enough geography. So we'll be talking about the possibility of Ariel Sharon's withdrawal from Gaza, leaving behind settlements on the West Bank, and the meeting this week between President Bush and Ariel Sharon, in which the United States changed its decades-long position vis-a-vis Jewish settlements on the West Bank. So we'll be talking about this new initiative and the internal politics of Israel. And then we'll talk with Roger Morris, who served on the National Security Council under Presidents Nixon and Johnson. We'll talk to him about the dysfunctional nature of the national security establishment in the White House. Apparently, this will be the subject of Bob Woodward's latest book about the war plans and how the United States got into this war. And, of course, this week, President Bush had a press conference, an unusual event in itself, and he appeared, at least to me, to be more the preacher-in-chief than the commander-in-chief. And he seems to basically, because he has such faith in his own judgments, this is more and more apparent that we have a leadership, a faith-based leadership that doesn't really seek to explain what they're doing, except to reassure us that he has strong convictions, and as though his convictions were sufficient rather than the facts. So we'll be talking to Roger Morris about that and also the 9/11 hearings this last week. I'm now speaking with Dr. David Newman, who's a professor of political geography and geopolitics at Ben-Gurion University in Israel. David, obviously, it's been a tumultuous week in Israel. Earlier in the week, of course, President Bush and Ariel Sharon met in the White House, and there was a change in the longstanding U.S. position vis-a-vis settlements on the West Bank. Many critics in Europe and in the Arab world feel that the United States has abandoned its position as an honest broker and even a broker and taken sides in this. What's the attitude in Israel, particularly in the press? Do the Israelis feel that that the United States has totally thrown their lot in with them?
Well, I think it's there are a lot of different opinions going around here. This is always the case with everything that happens in Israel. I think the most significant reaction is less the one that you're reflecting and that Europe is reflecting, that, you know, the United States has abandoned the roadmap and what it was talking about a year ago. And I think what is much more significant here is that for the first time possibly in 35 years, there seems to be a very real, concrete move for some significant withdrawal from the Gaza Strip and even parts of the West Bank, something which has been talked about in the past but which has never actually happened.
And do you think that, as some people do, that Ariel Sharon is about the only person who could actually do anything in terms of removing settlements? It's the same argument that it took a Nixon to open up China.
Well, it's the same argument that happened here, that it took a Menachem Begin to, you know, withdraw from the Sinai Peninsula and have the peace agreement with Egypt. It's often been argued that only a right-wing government can really implement peace agreements, because they will always carry the left half of the country with them, and then also carry some of their own supporters with them, whereas the same plans put forward by a Labour or left-wing government are always opposed by at least half of the country. So it's the same sort of argument that's going on here. But even in terms of who the right-wing leaders are, Sharon is actually the only Israeli politician who in the past has actually removed settlements. He was the person who removed the settlements of northern Sinai, of Yamit, under the terms of the Camp David Agreement. And although he is known as the champion of settlements, the person who built them, I think the settlers realise that this is one leader who could actually remove them as well.
Now, what's going on there in Israel in terms of the political left or the absence of the political left? Everything that happened this week in the White House, and many critics have suggested that this Bush throwing his lot in with Sharon isn't so much as the United States making a change in its policy to a country, but actually making a change in its policy to the country's leader in order to help him out with the May 7th vote within the Likud party itself on his plan to withdraw from Gaza but to retain the West Bank settlements. So this is really, we're talking about an intra-Likud debate. So where's the other half of the political spectrum?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I don't necessarily interpret it in that way. I don't think it's a direct intervention of Bush in getting the Likud party behind Sharon. I think, as a matter of fact, today, two of the three leading ministers who was not clear whether they would or would not support the internal Likud referendum, the education minister, Livnat, and the finance minister, Bibi Netanyahu, former prime minister, have both come out today and said they will support Sharon. I think that's pretty much given the vote in his hand, although, of course, it's still 3 weeks away and a lot can happen in Israeli politics in that time. But in terms of where the left wing or the Labour Party or what's left of the Labour Party stands, they're really in a no-win situation. They can't come out and say they oppose the plan because, of course, this is more than they have themselves actually ever implemented at any stage. Even they never got as far. They may have spoken about withdrawal from the West Bank and Gaza, but they've never implemented anything as such. And if Sharon was to come out of Gaza, even as only seen as only a first stage, then, you know, that is something they would definitely support and they would have to support. On the other hand, they can't come out in too supportive of the plan because, of course, they see it as a backing down from the roadmap and as the ultimate two-state solution, which would mean withdrawal from significant parts of the West Bank as well.
And does the assassination of Rantisi play into this? I mean, is it a part of the offensive on Sharon's part to bring his party on side?
Well, I mean, I don't think it was necessarily planned for that particular purpose. I mean, the Israeli government, Sharon, has made it very clear for some time now that the Hamas leaders are one of his major targets in the fight against terror. But I do think that the government and Sharon showing that it continues to play very hard the fight against terror at the same time as it is talking partial withdrawal and interim peace agreements, I think the two go together because, of course, the opponents of any withdrawal from the Gaza Strip, particularly the settlers themselves, argue that all such withdrawal is, in a sense, Israel giving a prize to the terrorists. And by Sharon at the same time taking out some of the major Hamas leaders is, in a sense, his response to that argument.
Now, Dr. David Newman, is the withdrawal from Gaza, I mean, I understand that the IDF, the military, hate having to deploy there, and there have been a number of reports from Israel saying that this is actually very much in their interest to get out of this place. It's a total drain on their resources, that. So is that what's driving it? Because on the other side, the argument is that any Israeli leader is going to have a hard time pulling the settlers out of any real settlement because you'll have the pictures of screaming people and trying to tie themselves to their buildings and with the army having to move them out. And one of the reasons that nothing's been done in terms of the settlement issue is that the people just don't have the political courage they're just afraid of these images and of this sort of the army having to forcibly remove people.
Yeah, well, I think both of your arguments are correct. I think there's no question that all governments, including the left-wing governments of Rabin, of Barak, who wanted much more significant withdrawals, have always been very afraid to really touch the settlements when really, I mean, it's obvious that if you're going to have some form of a peace agreement with territorial compromise, settlements are going to have to be evacuated. But the Israeli public knows that it's not just the images on the television, it's the fact that the first real settlements to be evacuated, not the sort of tin pot huts that, you know, were set up 2 weeks ago and put down today, but the real settlements where people have been living in and bringing up their families for 10, 15, 20 years, this is going to be a very difficult scene for the Israeli public to go through. There's going to be huge opposition. There are going to be demonstrations, perhaps even violence, way beyond what happened in Northern Sinai 20 years ago. At the same time, the precedent has to be set somewhere. The process has to start somewhere. And if it's going to start somewhere, then much more of the Israeli public support the withdrawal from Gaza than they do from the West Bank. Because a lot of the Israeli public see the Gaza Strip as being a drain on Israel's resources. Some of the settlements are relatively small, where you have large numbers of soldiers having to look after the security. So the security argument that the settlements contribute to security is not so relevant there. We're talking about a few thousand amongst nearly a million Palestinians in one of the most micro-densely populated regions in the world. So far more of the Israeli public are prepared to support a withdrawal from Gaza than from the West Bank, and this may be the precedent that is necessary for future settlement withdrawals in other areas.
And also, Gaza is where Hamas is centered. So is that a part of the calculus to, you know, by removing, pulling out of Gaza, they will hope, are they trying to undercut Hamas's appeal?
No, I would say on the contrary, that is one of the problems of the Gaza withdrawal. And some of the analyses of why Israel is intent now on taking out the Hamas leaders is to try and create a situation where the Palestinian Authority will take over the Gaza Strip after Israeli withdrawal and not the Hamas. And of course, both Israel and the Palestinian Authority are interested that it should not fall into the hands of the Hamas. That is a real danger after Israeli withdrawal. And that's why it's argued that Israel will now step up its taking out of Hamas leaders rather than the other way around.
But what's the difference between when you talk about the focus on the war on terror in terms of the Israeli public? What's the difference between Hamas, Islamic Jihad, and the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade? In other words, why go to war against one of the three groups that are responsible for suicide bombing?
I think Israel is really is really going against all of them at one and the same time. But clearly, in terms of the Gaza Strip, it is the Hamas whose support has increased there, who have grown in support. It was the place of Sheikh Yassin, it was the place of Ramzini, and it's the largest of the organizations. But I think in terms of how the Israeli public view these organizations, they don't view them differently in that sense. They view them as terrorist organizations, as fundamentalist organizations, as contrasted with the Palestinian Authority, who are now seen in terms of being the moderates who, if there is going to be a withdrawal, should be the ones to take over the local administration and governance.
And tell me, Dr. David Newman, in the terms of the reactions here too, first of all, there have been a number of reports that the White House was not particularly happy, because the way this is playing in the Arab world is that, you know, the pictures of Sharon and Bush meeting, and then a couple of days later, this Hamas leader is assassinated, and it's implied that somehow Bush gave Sharon the green light. And apparently there's some grumbling inside the White House and in the State Department. I think there was a statement was made saying it wasn't particularly helpful. So tell me, what is the, things in terms of United States relations with the Arab world and the Palestinians couldn't be worse. Before this incident, obviously the Iraq situation is exacerbating tensions, and this on top of it will obviously make matters worse. Is there in Israel itself a concern about Arab opinion? It seems to me that the Likud approach has always basically been, you know, almost contemptuous of the Arabs, you know, that it's about...
Well, let's put it this way. The withdrawal from Gaza is clearly a decision by the Israeli government to take a unilateral step. You know, the disengagement is a unilateral step. It's not a negotiated step. And it's an argument which Sharon has put in over the past year or two by his argument saying we don't have partners because our partners are engaged in terrorism. Therefore, you know, if we can't have a negotiated agreement, let's have a unilateral agreement on our terms. And that is relevant to the creation of the separation fence in a location decided by Israel and in terms of a unilateral disengagement or withdrawal from the Gaza Strip. I do think that Israel, particularly Sharon in particular, over the last two or three years, has cultivated very successfully the connection with the United States and that we have a common war or a common fight against terror and even against fundamentalism and terror. And I think at that level, Sharon has cultivated a very strong personal relationship with Bush in that they both see themselves as fighting against terror. It was not something, by the way, which happened immediately after 9/11. It took 6 or 8 months after 9/11 for Sharon to sort of succeed in putting Israel's fight against terror within the same category. But I think that's a very strong element that he uses every time he visits the White House, which, as you know, he does very often in that sense. I have doubts, strong doubts, to say, you know, that he, at the White House, he said to Bush, you know, this is the person I'm going to take out in the next week. I doubt it very much. But I am sure that he told Bush something of the account that we continue to fight against terror at the same time that we start our process of disengagement.
The analogies, though, between what America and Israel share in common in terms of this war on terror seem to be rather tenuous at best. I mean, the analogy would be if the United States was occupying Canada and we're having a problem with the Canadians. And I mean, the war, Bin Laden is a virtual state, a transnational threat. Isn't the problem in Israel basically a national problem about two nations not being able to agree about the same land?
Yeah, well, obviously that's in the eyes of the beholder, and it also is in the eyes of which side of the political spectrum you stand on. And, of course, it's a lot to do with terminologies. Is this terrorism? Is this fighting for freedom? Is this fighting for self-determination? I think it's fair to say that the average Israeli on the street, even the left-wing Israeli, who is prepared to go much further than Sharon and is prepared for a total withdrawal from the Gaza Strip and most, if not all, of the West Bank. Nevertheless, I think the average Israeli on the street sees the Palestinian fight for independence as a fight of terrorists, if only because it often takes place on the school buses and, you know, in shopping malls and in places where civilian populations are around.
Well, let me ask you though about the two-track situation, where you have, I believe you know a lot of the people involved, that there's always been this informal group of Israelis.
Oh, you mean the track two?
Track two, yeah.
Yeah.
I'm just saying that they've had a long-standing relationship with their Palestinian counterparts, and then Yossi Beilon, who started the Oslo process, and that they've always stayed in touch, and that one of the fears that have been expressed on the part of the Palestinians to their Israeli friends is, look, if you guys don't make a deal soon or do something about this situation, we're the ones that are going to be taken out by Hamas and the terrorists because, and we already had recently an assassination of a PLO official.
Yeah, I think Israeli governments are very well aware of that, and I think Sharon himself is aware of that.
Would Sharon care about
it,
though?
The longer it goes without a significant agreement on the ground taking place, This only increases the frustration amongst the Palestinians. It pushes more and more into the radical camp, a camp who believe that you can achieve nothing through negotiation, therefore violence is the only alternative. And I have no doubt that is also a consideration in an Israeli government's policy.
But does Sharon care? Because the hardline Likudniks could say, well, you know, if the moderates start getting assassinated by the radicals on the Palestinian side, the hardline and Likudniks could say, well, see, we told you so, you know?
Yeah, but I think what's interesting is that in Israel in the past 2 years, despite the fact that you've had some of the worst incidents of suicide bombings and, you know, carnage against civilian population inside Israel, there has been at one and the same time a growing consensus, if that's the right word to use. Consensus is a very problematic word in Israel, but there's sort of a growing consensus of people who believe that at the end of the day, if there is going to be a solution to the conflict, and there may never be one, but if there is to be one, it's going to be something around a two-state solution. And that includes people in the sort of, I would say, hard center and moderate right, such as Likud Party, who a few years ago would not have supported the idea of a two-state solution. So I think there are two parallel discourses going on here. One is the fight against terror, and the other is the move towards some form of political resolution of the conflict.
And but what's happening, though, in terms of obviously by making Arafat the issue, to some it looks like another excuse not to get anything done. Now, apparently, the latest Palestinian Prime Minister recently told Yossi Beilon, he said, "Look, you know, if I were to go out and announce a peace deal with the Israelis, my neighbors would kill me. But if Arafat were to announce a peace deal with the Israelis, they'd be dancing in the streets." So the point being that as corrupt and failed a leader as Arafat may be, he's still the only one that can deliver. So is that still a fact on the ground?
Yeah, well, I don't want to comment on that particular statement because I'm not an expert on Palestinian society.
Right.
It's hard enough for me to understand the complexities of Israeli society without being an expert on the other side. But I do think Arafat still commands a huge following, a huge control, even if only as a figurehead. You know, the more that both the Israelis and the Americans say Arafat is irrelevant, he's not a partner. So in terms of the public image, he becomes even more relevant to a certain extent. And I think you're right. Yes, I think if Arafat were to come out very clearly in support of a particular agreement, the chances of a larger amount of the Palestinian state buying into that is far, far greater.
So what's going to happen, though, in terms... I mean, they're still marginalising Arafat, you know, and the White House is pretty adamant that they want nothing to do with him. I just don't understand it. Even if the guy is personally corrupt, as many have said, then, you know, pay him off, but keep him in the picture.
Yeah, I don't think, I mean, you're talking to the converted. I mean, I don't think it's an issue of his own personal corruption as such. It's much more of an issue of do Israeli leaders, particularly Sharon, who, of course, he and Arafat have a long, long history going back 20 and 30 years, do they believe that Arafat is able to deliver a peace deal, not just to write his name on the signature, but can he deliver it in terms of the implications for security, stability, reducing the level of violence and so on? And I think most Israeli leaders, particularly the present government, do not believe or are not prepared to believe that he is able to do that. On the other hand, they recognize the fact that no one is going to replace Arafat as long as he is alive, and that any Palestinian prime minister is always going to be dependent on Arafat's agreements or decisions, which is why I think Sharon has come round to deciding we, Israel, are going to act unilaterally. That is what he means when he says we don't have a partner. Many of us involved in these various Track 2 talks think there are many other partners out there, but clearly, if you believe that Arafat is the only one who can deliver, but on the other hand, you're not prepared to talk to him, your alternative is either do nothing or do something unilaterally, and that's what Israel is doing at the moment.
Well, finally, David Newman, you obviously lived through the Oslo experience, and it's worth noting that Ariel Sharon made his sort of political comeback, if you will, opposing Oslo, and so did Netanyahu, both determined to kill it. Now, for a while, it worked up until the assassination of Yitzhak Rabin. Israelis were gambling in Jericho, shopping for furniture in Jerusalem. There was no violence. I mean, you know, the idea of an Israeli going into the West Bank now would be suicidal. So what has happened in these years? What was it all about? What was achieved?
Yeah, well, I'm one of the few people in Israel who don't believe that Oslo is dead and buried. Not in terms, at least, of the basic principles that lay behind Oslo. Yes, the practicalities didn't succeed. And if you were to go back to that, you have to do it in a different way. But what basically was Oslo about was that there would be a negotiated solution bringing about the end of withdrawal on the one hand, Palestinian independence, although it wasn't used in the same terms as today, on the other hand. Actually, in fact, more people today talk about two states and Palestinian statehood in Israel than they did 10 years ago at the time of Oslo, which is quite ironical. On the one hand, people are saying Oslo is dead, but on the other hand, more people talk about a two-state solution than they did at that time. I think Oslo did set something in motion, which is you cannot really go back. You talk to Palestinians today. You accept there is a Palestinian leadership. You accept that there is some need for self-determination, governance, and whether you want to call it a Palestinian entity or a Palestinian state. These are things that you can't go back to. These were the situation of pre-Oslo, where each side continued not to recognize the other, to not recognize the legitimacy of the existence of the other. Oslo changed that once and for all, and in that sense, Oslo, to a certain extent, I won't say succeeded, but it had a very important impact. It put into motion the fact that you always have to seek your way back to talking to the other side if you're going to reach a political solution.
But still, in the intervening years have set the clock back, have enormous amount of blood and treasure. Blood has been shed, treasure has been lost, time has been wasted. It's very hard to understand how it could have happened that you had the beginnings of peace, almost 10 years ago, and now we're having to sort of hold our breath and see whether Sharon is serious and whether this Gaza withdrawal is going to happen or not. It begs the question of what was it all about.
Well, I think the difference is in Oslo, there was a sort of a very vague vision of what should be at the end of the road, very vague because it wasn't fully delineated in terms of Palestinian statehood. But there was no real experience of how you try the practicalities out. What happens when things break down? Do you need a third party, which at the time they felt they didn't need because they'd secretly negotiated it directly, Israelis and Palestinians and so on? I think we've learned a lot of lessons from the failure of the practicalities of Oslo, how it should be done another time around. There are a lot of Israelis out there today, myself included, who believe that if you're really going to do some serious withdrawal, you have to have third party out there, not just to monitor, but to really oversee the withdrawal and to make sure that things remain relatively stable and they don't allow violence to flare up again afterwards. So I think we've learned a lot of lessons from the way that Oslo failed in being implemented. But again, I say that the principles that were started at Oslo, that the two sides recognize the existence of each other, even if they hate each other, and they recognize that eventually there can only be political resolution of the conflict if there is ever to be resolution, I think that principle still applies.
And just in closing, Dr. David Newman, what's happening now in Israel? Because I think, isn't it true that the Holocaust Memorial is happening?
That's right. I think, the whole world at the moment is talking about yesterday's assassination of Ranzini. They're all talking about the Bush-Sharon agreement and whether Europe does buy into it and doesn't buy into it. And oddly enough, here in Israel, for the past hour and a half, it's completely off the news. The 24 hours of Holocaust Day began at 8 o'clock this evening in Israel. It's a day when the country goes into a completely different mode of thinking. Cafes, restaurants, cinemas are all closed by law for 24 hours. The TV stations are taken over about documentaries and very serious programs about Holocaust history and the Europe before World War II. And I think it makes everybody sort of step back for a minute, tone down the political polemics for 24 hours, think of it in a different way. I think, in both of the things we were talking about, the fight against terrorism, the need for peace, both become very poignant in a certain sense. On the one hand, people say, the Holocaust, we created the State of Israel so it should never happen again, and we're not going to allow people to kill us just because we're Jews. That's the fight against terrorism. But on the other hand, people say, well, you know, we created the state out of the ashes of the Holocaust so that one day we would finally get some peace, stability. We would be a normal state like all other states. And to do that, we have to have political resolution of the conflict.
I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles, Dr. David Newman.
Okay, thank you.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Marcel. Just speaking then with Dr. David Newman, a professor of political geography and geopolitics at Ben Gurion University in Israel. Let's now turn to the subject of the 9/11 hearings and the way the White House has handled the 9/11 hearings. It's worth noting that they were all John Ashcroft and George Tenet, all of the people supporting the White House who testified in the last week, all seem to be singing from the same hymnal, and that is they were all talking about the wall between criminal investigation and intelligence, between the idea that you've got to separate intelligence matters from domestic law enforcement matters. And, of course, this goes back to the 1947 National Security Act. And the notion that this wall is the reason why 9/11 happened is pretty preposterous. Let me turn to Roger Morris, who served on the National Security Councils under Presidents Johnson and Nixon. Roger, did you notice that it's as though Karl Rove orchestrated the collective defense, particularly with Ashcroft, where Ashcroft declassified a memo from Jamie Gorelick, who is one of the commissioners, apparently, delineating the so-called wall. Ironically and hypocritically, Ashcroft himself signed off on the very memo that he declassified in an attempt to shift the blame from the administration's failures prior to 9/11 to suggesting that somehow it's all the fault of this wall.
It was so familiar in the usual administration effort here to blame the Clinton administration or to scapegoat other officials. The truth, as far as I see it from having been on the inside, is that these walls are vastly over-exaggerated. Even in the old days when there was much less coordination than there was under the Clinton administration with all the walls that they were supposed to have imposed, even in the old days, the FBI had no difficulty getting a decent intelligence to the president, neither did the CIA. And the real failure here, of course, was the failure that no one could quite talk about or confront at Condoleezza Rice's hearing. The real failure, of course, lies with the National Security Advisor. That's her job. That's the job of the National Security Advisor, to make sure that this intelligence is melded and coordinated, to make sure that if there are gaps, if there are things that are not put together in a proper way, that's why she has a staff. That's why she or he, in past administrations, exists, quite literally, to overcome whatever institutional or bureaucratic or natural divisions there are, and they are legend, as you know, in the U.S. government, and no amount of edicts from on high to build walls or to tear walls down will ever quite suffice to take care of that. That's why the National Security Advisor's job is so essential. And Condoleezza Rice, I must say, though no one on the commission quite had the courage to say so, Condoleezza Rice has been a colossal failure in that respect. She's let down the country. She's let down certainly her president, her constituency of one, to whom she owes all loyalty and all her service. And, of course, she let down the some 3,000 who were killed on 9/11. So I don't think there's any question that the intelligence was adequate to have alerted the U.S. government on a much broader scale than this administration undertook to do. The president, as we know, stayed at his ranch in Crawford, clearing brush or whatever he does, driving that pickup around, talking to cronies and raising money even for the next campaign. Even then, we know a good deal of money was raised in latter 2001 at the time this was all happening. No one was paying attention because no one gave it any priority. not because the intelligence was so terrible or vague. I've looked at the hundreds of intelligence reports in my life, and what we now know about the presidential daily brief of August 6th and of other material was strikingly prescient and detailed and adequate. So all of this is I'm afraid, rather a red herring across the trail, to use an old phrase.
Well, it's particularly disturbing when you have a president who seems out of his depth, who seems to delegate most of the running of the country to Dick Cheney while he goes out and does speeches and raises money. And, you know, just lately, in fact, in his press conference the other day, he basically said, well, you know, vis-a-vis Iraq, well, you know, if General Abizaid wants more troops, I'm just waiting to find out from what he wants. His passivity, and then he said, vis-a-vis the United Nations, I'm just waiting to see what Brahimi wants. And she seemed to be that way, too. She said, well, you know, George said one thing and the FBI said another, and, you know, it's not my fault. I mean, this is like the blind leading the blind.
The truth is that they're just not only colossally corrupt in a number of ways as an administration, they're colossally incompetent. And, you know, we must remember the history here. Condoleezza Rice was introduced by George H.W. Bush, George the Elder, to his ambitious son in the summer of 1998 at Kennebunkport one weekend. George W. was positioning to run for the presidency, and Condoleezza and Paul Wolfowitz were introduced by the father specifically to tutor this young man, who was woefully unprepared in foreign affairs, as he was in most realms of government. But he had been an affable front man in Austin and as governor of Texas, and was now prepared to go for the White House. No one could be more aware of George W. Bush's limitations than his national security advisor. She has been with him in effect from the beginning, which for him was 1998, in preparing for all of this. No one could be more aware of his limitations, of his prejudices, of his refusal, almost adamant refusal, to read things for himself. His closed and very narrow-minded view of all public affairs, and it was really her responsibility to try, as best she could, to transcend all this and to build firewalls, to build barriers that would have served the country. She takes an oath, as all of us did, to defend the Constitution of the United States, not the administration of a given president. And I, frankly, with all of the sort of knaves and fools who have occupied that office over the years, and their record is spotty indeed, I don't think we've had a single national security advisor who has failed so dramatically in something that, of course, had an awful toll in blood and treasure.
Well, unfortunately, Condoleezza Rice has just made this extraordinary statement that she expects a terrorist attack sometime in October, or wouldn't be surprised if bin Laden struck in October, just before the elections. And she used the analogy of what happened in Spain, where the Madrid train bombings affected the outcome of the elections. I think probably somewhat different reasons. I think it's because the conservative government lied to the people and tried to pin it on ETA, rather than where the obvious evidence trail was leading. So she's sort of putting the country on notice that John Kerry is working with al-Qaeda.
You know, it's absolutely amazing. Her statements, I think, are only an example of what we've seen for the last two and a half years, and that this administration does the most outrageous things, says the most outrageous things with almost utter impunity. There's no real calling her to account on the floor of the United States Congress by either party. Frankly, if I were a Republican, I'd be very distressed that my president, who looked fairly sure of re-election even a year ago, had not been warned or prepared more thoroughly for the occupation and for all the other blunders that they've run into. But She gets away literally with murder, and so do the others. And incidentally, I wanted to add, you know, if Cheney is slightly unhinged, as Colin Powell is now saying privately, and other people are suggesting, again, this is something that the National Security Advisor knew quite well. She had worked with Cheney in previous administrations when she was a key aide to Brent Scowcroft and had been George H.W. Bush's chief advisor on the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe. At the fall of the Soviet Union in the early 1990s. All these people know each other very well. Colin Powell knows Rumsfeld and Cheney and Wolfowitz and all of them. They've all worked together for years, known each other for decades. There are no mysteries here, and there really is an awful failure of courage and of responsibility, really craven, about what's happening. There are no resignations, Ian, as you see, no resignations of note at any senior level in this administration, and I find that incredible.
Well, what do you think is going on, though? Because where's the real failure here? Because these people are truly the wrecking crew, and they don't seem to be... I mean, for the first time ever, the White House press acted like a real press corps in this last press conference, where the president spoke for 17 minutes before he even took questions. And it seems to me that there's the absence of anybody in Congress of any stature and the lack of questioning on the part of the press, who just take Karl Rove's spin and faithfully and dutifully print it or broadcast it. I mean, the wall being example. I mean, the fact that they had this collective defense in their 9/11 hearings, blaming everything that happened on 9/11 on the idea that there's this wall inside the intelligence world that makes it impossible to deal with terrorism. I mean, it's about... the analogy would be the police complaining about Miranda, but they've obviously had to learn to live with it. I mean, obviously, law enforcement would work much more efficiently if we didn't have a Bill of Rights and a Constitution. I mean, in other words, I just wish there was some gravitas in these arguments, or at least there was somebody that could
well, it's a seamless web of failure, really, because it is a failure on the part of the Congress of the United States. I don't hear the Democrats standing up and delivering a Jacques Hughes on the floor of the Senate or the House, or really making the case. The Democratic candidate, since he cinched the nomination, has been moving steadily right and has been relatively subdued, even muted on many of these cases. His position, as you know, on Iraq and what to do about this absolute disastrous dead end is to pretty much to stay the course with a bit of multilateral varnish on it. It's distressingly similar to George W.'s. There's an obvious failure in the bureaucracy. You don't see resignations or even mass protests of the kind that we once saw in Vietnam. You don't. You're not really seeing people in the streets here. The press has been complicit all along. No one. Interesting. I thought that they asked George W. Had he made any mistakes? Was he willing to admit any errors in the past? My goodness, the press has been the last to admit that they purveyed in a very credulous and irresponsible way most of the administration claims, which went unchecked, of weapons of mass destruction and Iraq's ties to Al Qaeda. The failure is all around, and it's widespread in this administration. It isn't just the four or five blind dwarves here at the top. It's a layered regime of 15, 16, 17, 18 people in the Pentagon and the Department of State in key positions who still believe this was the correct policy. And don't ever forget, as a final point, how incredibly isolated they are. They've isolated themselves even more than the ordinary White House. They're holed up in their own self-justifying logic. They're supported by Fox News and by the right-wing fundamentalist majority in the House, and they're still running a respectable campaign here, according to the poll numbers. I think this election is by no means a foregone conclusion. So they really have no reason, either in pressure from the other side, pressure in the Congress or anywhere else, and certainly no reason yet in pressure from the press or the public, to face up to who and what they are.
But you just, Roger Morris, you just mentioned the right-wing Christian fundamentalist influence. I believe that Karl Rove is the point man for them, although the former head of the Christian Coalition is now running Bush's re-election in the South. The press conference that he gave the other day, he struck me as being more and more the preacher-in-chief than the commander-in-chief. And it seems to me that it is clear, and the press say, well, he's just shoring up his base, as if you need to shore up those evangelicals. They don't need shoring up. The thing that's so clear to me is that this is really who this man is. This is a man who was a drunk and a coke fiend and a failure. His daddy kept bailing him out. And then one day the Lord Jesus came into his life, and look what happened. He became president. So who can argue with that? And he got his second epiphany, though, from what we all understand. His second epiphany, which ties into the first, happened on 9/11, where he said to himself, this is why God has made me president, because I've got to fight this evil. So it's so clear that everything that he says is about his faith. But democracy is not about faith. It's not about theology. Democracy is by definition a secular process, isn't it?
Well, absolutely. We have here in this so-called war on terror a face-off of religious zealots, after all. Osama was supposed to have been anti-American up to a point, but when the bases and the troops stayed behind in Saudi Arabia after the first Gulf War, it tipped him over the edge in the same way you're suggesting that 9/11 tips George W. here into his religious mission. I think that's right. I think that's all there is here to this man. There is this sort of crackpot religious zealotry, and that explains the self-justification, the complete lack of introspection or any kind of critique inside the White House. This is a true believer in the worst and most narrow sense of the term, and he's supported, after all, by not a majority, but by a very sizable minority and a very powerful faction in the Congress, and no one has yet quite taken this on in the mainstream media, least of all in the Democratic Party. Has anyone really begun to suggest that what we have here is a betrayal of the most fundamental constitutional and political principles? You've got a kind of theocracy, a de facto theocracy in the White House, and it's committing us to folly both at home and abroad.
And in terms of the folly abroad, Roger Morris, I guess if you're an ideologue, and particularly if you're a religious zealot, you're obviously blind to reality, or at least to the real world. And of course, there's an expression that reality bites, and it seems that reality is biting in Iraq. And it seems to me that we're actually at a point in Iraq where the press conference that the president gave the other day, he kept reinforcing the notion that he's going to stay the course, he's not going to cut and run. It seems to me that it's pretty manifestly clear that there isn't much difference between cutting and running and staying the course in terms of real-world conditions. In other words, things are so bad that you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't. So I guess to be pragmatic, they just should pull out, because at the end of the day, they're going to be driven out.
It's going to be a disaster all around, just as Vietnam was. I think that's the only plausible strategy to declare victory, having given the Iraqi people, and this would have to be what Rove would have to draft, having given the Iraqi people a chance at democracy to let them now decide their own fate. My own personal view of this is that the Iraqis will do just fine. The real danger here is that if we stay much longer, not only will we be driven out, but the successor government will be a radical Islamic government that will set the stage for even more disaster in the future. And we mustn't forget, this is the most nationalist society in the Middle East. It's the society that was, after all, the most gifted in scientific and technological terms. Only a matter of time until a reasonably hostile successor regime in Baghdad would begin to do exactly what Saddam Hussein did, which was to try to build some kind of weapons counterweight, some kind of military counterweight to the overweening power of the West. This is a long-term disaster that we have entered upon with the most fundamentally mistaken presumption. So, yes, they need to get out. They need to give it over to the UN. They need to surrender both their pretense and their control. These are not things that this administration, Ian, in my view, will ever be able to do. So I think if George W. Bush remains in power, we are locked onto a path that leads only to deepening disaster.
But won't it get so much worse, so much quicker? Because it seems to me that before the election, in other words, I think it's going to decide the election, isn't it, in Kerry's favor? Because if the rebels are now crimping the supply lines, so then you have the situation where it's harder and harder to supply the fortresses, these little mini Alamos all around the country. The CPA, the people who are supposed to be making this transition to democracy work, don't do anything. They're a bunch of carpetbaggers. They sit behind razor wire and draw these massive salaries, and they don't get out and help the people. The military is trying to help the people, but they're also trying to protect themselves from an increasingly angry populace. If things are seem to be getting bad, and we're at 700 lost now on the American side. I just can't see anything changing this escalating dynamic.
Well, I don't think we've seen anything yet, unfortunately. This is, of course, in part an uprising simply at the fact of the American occupation and at the repression of Sadr's forces, the absolute colossal blunder that Bremer made. Anyone who'd looked at the man's record could have said he was one of the least fit to run this occupation. But, the tragedy here, Ian, is that I think that many American kids there in the occupation think they're doing a good and honorable thing. They're trying to do the right thing. The occupation has been a combination, I think, of sort of decent civic works in as it was supposed to be, and brutal repression, torture, and concentration camp incarceration, and of course wanton use of their superior weaponry against these people. It's been half civil and half brutal, and the brutal part is the one, of course, that has aroused this uprising. It came much sooner than I thought it was going to come, but you've got now something really extraordinary in Iraqi history. You've got a genuine united front between the Sunni and the Shia. The last time this happened, if anyone would ever crack a history book, read anything beyond Karl Rove's memos in the White House, the last time this happened was in the 1920s when the British were driven out in an extraordinarily bloody and humiliating exit. This is just repeating that tragedy all over again.
So Bremer, he replaced Jay Garner, and it turns out that Jay Garner, the first thing Jay Garner wanted to do was to keep the Iraqi military together and not disband them, and to hand over authority to the Iraqis as soon as possible, like within weeks.
Oh, Garner had worked with the Kurds during the first Gulf War and had actually had some on-the-ground, hands-on experience. Bremer is a Washington bureaucrat. He's a conference room warrior. You're quite right about the concertina wire and these rather pale carpetbaggers sitting behind it issuing these edicts that no one pays any attention to. Bremer was not equipped for this job, knew nothing to speak of about the Middle East, was a hack, originally a Kissinger hack, and sort of passed on to successive administrations, and a so-called expert on terror who had never distinguished himself in that realm, certainly, and he was an available front man to do this. And of course, since no one, if we get back to the original point, no one in Washington really had any expertise about this part of the world or what they were entering on. The National Security Advisor and the President of the United States never even read the multi-volume Department of State study on the occupation, which did apparently flag in a number of ways some of the problems that they were going to face. I don't think they would have prevented them, but at least they would have been somewhat more prepared prepared for them. But what you have is this consummate tragedy of an American army of volunteers, kids, and a lot of National Guardsmen in disproportionate numbers over there doing a job that they were never expected to do or never really trained to do, sacrificing their lives for the most venal and intellectually disreputable combination of motives. I mean, profit and power and religious zealotry and all the rest. I think, in summary, it's, as I've said many times, I think this is the worst single moment in American foreign policy, certainly in my lifetime, in the last 60 years of my experience with it.
Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking with Roger Morris, who served on the National Security Council under Presidents Johnson and Nixon. I thank Louis Vandenberg for producing and research and Mark Maxwell for engineering. And, of course, this program can be reached at ianmasters.org, where this program and all previous programs are archived.